with medical experts from Mayo Clinic, Johns Hopkins, the Cleveland Clinic, and more, this is Med Clinic Radio.
Med Clinic Radio.
Exploring the latest developments in health and medicine and what they mean to you. Here's your host, Gina Tedesco.
More than 1 in 10 Americans have diabetes, and roughly 1 in 3 have pre-diabetes. This week, we'll talk with a diabetes specialist from Johns Hopkins who recently wrote a summary of the latest guidelines to lower blood sugar and reduce the risk of cardiovascular disease. Then, on average, someone in the U.S. has a stroke every 40 seconds. Prompt treatment can minimize brain damage, and every moment is critical. On this week's Mayo Q&A segment, the chair of Mayo Clinic's Division of Stroke and Cerebrovascular Diseases will explain what you need to know about stroke warning signs and who is most at risk. Stick around. Med Clinic Radio begins in just a moment.
Welcome back to Med Clinic Radio. Once again, here's Gina Tedesco.
With scientists developing so many new medicines for diabetes, how can you be sure your doctor is up to date on all the latest approaches and drugs? Now, a Johns Hopkins endocrinologist has reviewed the recent trial results and guidelines, yielding a sort of roadmap for healthcare providers, including recommendations. It's published in the New England Journal of Medicine. Joining us now is the author, Dr. Rita Kalyani. Doctor, your article is the first clinical practice review that the journal has published on diabetes management in almost 10 years. That really speaks to the need for this review, doesn't it?
It does indeed. And there's been so much that has changed in the landscape for diabetes treatment, especially over the past 4 to 5 years, that this review is quite timely with changes that we've seen in clinical care for people with diabetes.
And focusing on type 2 diabetes patients, they're more than twice as likely to develop arteriosclerotic cardiovascular disease and heart failure than those without the disease, aren't they?
They are. Cardiovascular disease remains a major cause of illness and death in people with type 2 diabetes. In fact, it's the cause of death for the majority of individuals with type 2 diabetes. And so cardiovascular risk factor reduction has always been a priority in clinical practice. But as you mentioned, we know that people with diabetes continue to have a twofold or higher risk of having a heart attack, stroke, or peripheral arterial disease, what we call macrovascular complications. And yet, up until now, our toolbox has been limited in terms of what we can offer our patients with diabetes to reduce that risk. But we now have many exciting new drug options that we can offer them.
And your review can guide doctors on the best medicines to lower blood sugar and reduce that risk for cardiovascular disease. But in some cases, the same drug can do both. Is that correct?
That is correct. So beginning in 2008, the Food and Drug Administration mandated that all new drugs approved for diabetes had to demonstrate in a post-marketing cardiovascular outcome trial that there was no unacceptably increased risk of cardiovascular events. And this was spurred in part by findings from one of the existing drugs on the market, rosiglitazone, that was found after it was on the market to be possibly related to an increased risk of cardiovascular events, although that wasn't shown in a reanalysis. But because of that and other ongoing concerns, the committee decided and FDA then issued a guidance for industry that all new drugs for diabetes would have to have these cardiovascular outcome trials. And this was really done to demonstrate safety, that all new drugs were safe. But what we saw unexpectedly is that several agents in the GLP-1 receptor agonist class and the SGLT2 inhibitor classes had superiority compared to placebo. That is, they were more effective at reducing cardiovascular events than placebo, in addition to what was already known about their glucose-lowering effects as well.
And you mentioned metformin. Does this remain the initial go-to drug for people with type 2 diabetes?
Metformin has been on the U.S. market since 1995, and it remains the most widely used initial drug for people with type 2 diabetes. And We know that this particular drug is very effective at lowering blood glucose. It can lower A1C by up to 2%. It's relatively well tolerated. It's inexpensive. And there's a long clinical experience, even though it's been in the United States since 1995, it's been in Europe for much longer than that. And so it is often prescribed as the first drug for people who have type 2 diabetes. After that, there's many options of other agents that can be used. And this is often decided on by patient preferences, the effects that certain drugs have on weight, the cost of drugs, the route of administration. Some are given orally, some are injected. And we do have one that's inhaled, an inhaled insulin product too. And then also some of them have other effects on different coexisting conditions, such as heart, liver disease or bone disease. And so these are all factors that historically have gone into our decision-making process as clinicians when deciding on a second agent. We now have, from these cardiovascular outcome trials that I described, really strong evidence that several of the agents in these newer classes that I mentioned, the GLP-1 receptor agonists and the SGLT2 inhibitors, have additional benefits for cardiovascular risk reduction. And so this would be drugs that we would consider usually after metformin is already incorporated into the regimen.
We're visiting with Dr. Rita Kalyani, Johns Hopkins endocrinologist, on an extensive review and recommendations of treatments for diabetes that the New England Journal of Medicine just recently published. Doctor, what's noteworthy, or one of the noteworthy things, is your recommendation that doctors should consider additional drugs to prevent heart disease, even if the patient's A1C blood sugar test comes up in the normal range. Is that pretty new?
Yes, you have pinpointed one of the major paradigm shifts that we have had in our clinical care guidelines over the past 3 to 4 years. You know, up until that point, we focused primarily on glucose lowering, A1C, as a surrogate marker for risk of long-term complications. And that's been informed by several long-term trials, such as the United Kingdom Prospective Diabetes Study, that demonstrated that with more intensive glucose or A1C lowering, participants had reduced risk of what we call microvascular complications, eye disease, nerve disease, and kidney disease. But there was always a question whether glycemic lowering was as effective at reducing the risk of heart disease, because the evidence was not definitive in some of these hallmark trials. So we now have new evidence from the cardiovascular outcome trials that I described that have been mandated since 2008 from the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, that irrespective of the A1C differences between the placebo arms and the drug arms, in fact, at the end of these trials, the A1C differences were minimal because patients could have their background therapies continually titrated as needed by their healthcare providers. And so really, it was just the drug effect that we saw. And based on these trials, those drugs, irrespective of A1C, because as I mentioned, the A1C differences were not large between the treatment and placebo arms, we saw the cardiovascular risk reduction. And so now we recommend in the clinical guidelines, and this is pretty universal in all the guidelines that have mention of the newer therapies from the United States, Canada, and Europe as well, that even if someone is at their A1C target, and that's individualized, so it can be different for each individual, but even if they are at their A1C target, if they have a history of cardiovascular disease, then it is recommended that one of these newer agents that has demonstrated cardiovascular benefit should be incorporated into their regimen.
Up next on MedClinic Radio, more about the recommendations from this comprehensive guide on drugs for diabetes. Back in a moment.
Let's return to MedClinic Radio with your host, Gina Tedesco.
We're back now with Dr. Rita Kalyani, endocrinologist and associate professor at Johns Hopkins. She reviewed the latest research, drugs, and standards of care, developing a guide for doctors to treat their patients with diabetes. So, Dr. Kalyani, let's drill down a bit. You say most professional societies recommend that for women who are not pregnant and for men, there's a blood sugar target below 6.5 or 7. But what other factors should affect how a doctor sets the target sugar rate?
Glycemic targets or A1C targets are individualized for the person with diabetes. And there's a variety of factors that go into this shared decision-making process between the provider and the patient. For most patients who are not pregnant, as mentioned, the A1C target is usually less than 7%. Some societies recommend even less than 6.5%. But other factors that go into this decision-making process include where the patient is in the disease course of their disease. If they're newly diagnosed, we might be a little bit more aggressive with their A1C target, meaning we might aim for a lower A1C level to really maximize the benefit on reduction in complications. Whereas if they've had a longer duration of disease, we may not be as aggressive. The A1C target might be a little bit higher. If someone has existing complications, they already have cardiovascular disease or kidney disease or severe eye disease, what we call retinopathy, we also might be less aggressive with the A1C target because our goals of care have changed. It's not to prevent the complication from happening, but it's to prevent the progression of the complication. If an individual is at high risk for hypoglycemia or low blood glucose, we also tend not to be as aggressive. For many of our older patients with diabetes, we aim for A1C targets even as high as 8% because they might have other comorbidities, other medical conditions. They might be on multiple medications that put them at higher risk for hypoglycemia. And so that is certainly a consideration as well. So there are many factors that go into that decision.
Your review mentions several types of agents and drug classes. I'm going to ask you now to drill down on how they work very, very briefly and how they can be beneficial. First, as you mentioned before, the GLP-1 receptor agonists. How do they work?
The GLP-1 receptor agonists are synthetic versions of a hormone that our body produces known as GLP-1. That's why they're known as GLP-1 receptor agonists. And these medications stimulate the cells in the pancreas, known as the beta cells, to produce more insulin. But they only do so after a patient has eaten. So they are considered relatively safe in that the risk of hypoglycemia is low. They happen to help with blood sugar excursions after meals because, as mentioned, they're effective really only when someone is eating food. And they can also lead to effects on appetite suppression at the level of the brain and have effects on the liver as well, which reduces breakdown of glucose stores in the liver. All these effects can result in weight loss. And in fact, at high doses, some of the GLP-1 receptor agonists, such as liraglutide, are also approved for weight loss management too. So these agents help with blood glucose excursions after meal, and they also can help with weight loss as well.
And what are some of the other names? You mentioned one name. What are some of the other names of the GLP-1 receptor agonists?
There are multiple agents currently on the market in the United States. They are injectable medications. So in addition to liraglutide, there's dulaglutide, semaglutide, lixizenatide, and exenatide. We also have one oral version. Semaglutide comes in both an injectable and oral version as well.
And what about the sodium glucose cotransporter type 2 inhibitors? How do they work?
Yeah, this is the newest kid on the block, if you will. They were first approved in the United States in 2013 as a class, and they act through a very different mechanism. They prevent the kidneys from reabsorbing glucose from the urine. So what happens ordinarily is that when people have something sweet to eat or the sugar levels go high, usually any excess blood sugar is released in the body through the urine and then reabsorbed to maintain normal glucose levels. What the SGLT2 inhibitor drug class does is it prevents that reabsorption of the glucose back into the body. So in essence, you emit the excess blood glucose through your urine.
We've been talking with Dr. Rita Kalyani, associate professor and endocrinologist at Johns Hopkins, on her recently published review of treatments and guidelines for diabetes care. Again, Doctor, drilling down a bit, what do you recommend for patients with type 2 diabetes who have a history of heart failure with reduced amounts of blood pumped from the left ventricle specifically?
Yeah, so in these patients who have heart failure with a reduced ejection fraction, we also have good evidence from clinical trials that agents in the SGLT2 inhibitor class can be effective at reducing the progression of hospitalization to heart failure and reduce cardiovascular events such as death as well. And so we now have great options for patients who have type 2 diabetes and heart failure with reduced ejection fraction as well. And the two agents are empagliflozin and dapagliflozin that can be used in patients with heart failure with reduced ejection fraction.
Doctor, you say that diabetes care needs to be more collaborative in the future. Why is that?
Well, as you can imagine, now that we see several agents that we use for lowering blood glucose, what we call glucose-lowering drugs, also have these tremendous benefits on reducing cardiovascular events in patients who have a history of cardiovascular disease, reducing hospitalization for heart failure in patients who have a history of heart failure with reduced ejection fraction, and also in reducing the progression of chronic kidney disease in patients with chronic kidney disease. We haven't talked too much about that, but that has also been found in the trials. The specialists, cardiologists and nephrologists, are also just as excited about using these drugs to prevent the relevant complications in patients with type 2 diabetes. And so as a result, clinical care will have to be increasingly collaborative because these diabetes drugs, or what has historically been used for diabetes management, are also now being used to prevent cardiovascular complications, heart failure complications, and kidney complications. And those specialists are also prescribing these drugs. And so it's important that we all communicate, particularly with the primary care provider as well, regarding what the comprehensive treatment plan is for patients with type 2 diabetes.
The newer drugs that you reviewed carried a higher price tag in many cases. Did your review also produce a recommendation on how to address cost barriers or how they should be considered as a factor in whether a doctor prescribes them compared to an older drug?
That's a really great question. And the review did not go into detail regarding cost, but it is important to note that these newer drugs are expensive in many countries, and they may not be options in low-resource settings. And we really need to think about how we can make these newer therapies more accessible for everyone with type 2 diabetes, and what other options we might have should these higher-cost ones not be available to reduce cardiovascular disease.
Dr. Rita Kalyani, associate professor and endocrinologist at Johns Hopkins, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Up next on our Mayo Clinic Q&A segment, what you need to know about stroke warning signs and who is most at risk, as Med Clinic Radio continues.
With your Mayo Clinic Radio Health Minute, I'm Vivian Williams. Pancreatic cancer is the most lethal cancer in the human body, with overall 5-year survival rates at just about 7%. There are no telltale signs for pancreatic cancer, and according to Dr. Santhi Swarup-Vege, symptoms like weight loss, abdominal pain, jaundice, and appetite loss are nonspecific.
Usually these people will have indigestion, acid reflux, before finally somebody thinks of doing a CT scan, and by that time it's already late.
Dr. Vege says treatments can be any combination of surgery, chemotherapy, radiation, and endoscopic procedures.
If it is localized to the pancreas and if it is not involving the major structures, then the best treatment, of course, is resection.
While a standard screening test doesn't exist, Mayo Clinic researchers are diligently working to create early screening opportunities. For more information, talk with your healthcare provider or visit mayoclinic.org.
You're listening to Med Clinic Radio, exploring the latest developments in health and medicine and what they mean to you. Once again, here's Gina Tedesco.
Nearly 800,000 Americans will suffer a stroke this year. Do you know the warning signs? With this week's Mayo Clinic Q&A, here's Dr. Helena Gazelka.
On average, someone in the United States has a stroke every 40 seconds. A stroke occurs when the blood supply to part of the brain is interrupted, depriving the brain of oxygen. It's important to recognize the warning signs of stroke because prompt treatment can minimize brain damage that can occur. So every moment is crucial. Here to discuss this with us today is the Division Chair of Stroke and Cerebrovascular Diseases at Mayo Clinic, Dr. Robert Brown. Bob, thank you for being here today.
Delighted to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
I think this is an incredibly common topic and occurrence that people should understand better than they do. So can you just describe for us first, Bob, what is it that we mean when we say the word stroke? What is happening?
Well, there are two main types of stroke, both of which affect the brain. The most common type of stroke, about 85% of strokes, is a lack of blood supply to the brain called an ischemic stroke or a cerebral infarction. So for whatever reason, the artery, which carries the oxygen carrying blood up to the brain, that artery becomes blocked. And then there's a lack of blood flow and the brain cells begin to die off. And then the other type of stroke, about 15% of all strokes, is what's called a hemorrhagic or a bleeding stroke, in which there's blood that spills outside of the artery into the brain tissue or surrounding the brain tissue.
And Bob, the first type that you mentioned where there's a clot that interrupts blood supply sounds a little bit about what happens to the heart when someone has a heart attack.
You're exactly right. A heart attack, also called a myocardial infarction, meaning a lack of blood flow and dying off of the heart cells. Similarly, a cerebral infarction is of the same general mechanism, meaning there's a lack of blood supply to the brain cells, and then those brain cells begin to die off.
And then the second type where there's bleeding, sometimes we hear of people having a brain aneurysm. Yeah. Is that the same thing?
It's a great question. And there are two main types of bleeding stroke. There's something called an intracerebral hemorrhage, in which there's bleeding into the brain tissue. And then there's another type that's called a subarachnoid hemorrhage. And that is a type of bleeding where it's over the lining of the brain. An aneurysm is the most common cause of that type of bleeding around the lining of the brain. So it's important to mention, though, that aneurysms are relatively common in people. About 2% of all adults have a brain aneurysm, but most of them never rupture. But sometimes you'll hear that somebody will say, oh, so-and-so had a brain aneurysm. And what they're implying there is that it was one of those brain aneurysms that actually ruptured and caused this blood to spill over the lining of the brain.
Interesting. So do strokes affect all people the same or similarly?
As I mentioned earlier, strokes can affect people of all ages. Admittedly, strokes are of increasing occurrence as we get older, but it's important to recognize that even young people in their 20s, 30s, 40s can have a stroke, and much less commonly in children. But a stroke can affect everyone in a little bit different way. And the reason is any part of the brain can be affected by a stroke. And then that is what leads to the specific symptoms based on what part of the brain is lacking in blood flow.
I think we mentioned earlier that strokes can cause brain cells to actually die, either of those types of strokes. Mm-hmm. What happens when brain cells die?
Well, as the blood flow is lacking to the brain, that is, that artery is blocked for whatever reason, those brain cells then are lacking in oxygen and can no longer function. And as they are struggling to function, eventually they die because they're just not able to get the oxygen they need. And once they stop receiving that oxygen, then you will begin to see the symptoms quickly evolving that relate to a stroke.
If the brain cells die, are they rejuvenated or do they grow back?
Well, unfortunately, the brain is one of those parts of the body that once the cells have died off, they cannot reactivate. They cannot come back to life after they've died off. But as we will talk about, there are ways with various therapies, physical therapy, occupational therapy, speech therapy, to help people who have had a deficit. But most importantly, if a person has a stroke, we need to act quickly to try to prevent those brain cells from dying off in the first place.
Okay, speaking of acting quickly, in medicine, we often talk about the signs and symptoms of a disease or something or an occurrence. So a sign being something that we as medical professionals could see or anyone else could see, and then a symptom being something that the patient experiences. What about signs and symptoms of stroke?
Well, strokes tend to present with the sudden onset of difficulty doing something. In other words, sudden onset of weakness in the face, arm, or leg, sudden difficulty speaking or understanding others, sudden blindness in one eye or the other or both, sudden difficulty walking, sudden numbness on one side of the body or the other, sudden headache, unlike anything somebody has ever had before. So the sudden onset of symptoms, sudden onset of difficulty doing something, this is the key symptoms that should be recognized.
Supposing that one of our listeners is either experiencing signs and symptoms themselves or is with someone who is, what is the next step to take?
Mm-hmm. Well, most importantly, if those symptoms occur, call 911 and receive emergency medical care, because there are emergency-based treatments that are available that can lessen the impact of a stroke. And I should mention that one way for our listeners today to remember the stroke symptoms is the FAST acronym, F-A-S-T, F standing for facial droop, A for arm weakness, S for speech slurring, and T, time. Time to call 911 and seek emergency medical care.
Up next, we'll continue our Mayo Clinic Q&A look at strokes and what types of treatments can help as Med Clinic Radio continues.
Welcome back to Med Clinic Radio. Once again, here's Gina Tedesco.
Now we continue with our Mayo Q&A segment, a conversation with Dr. Robert Brown, Jr., Chair of Mayo Clinic's Division of Stroke and Cerebrovascular Diseases. Once again, here's Mayo Q&A host, Dr. Helena Gazelka.
Time is of the essence, because you've explained that time can make a difference on not only whether brain cells die, but also how extensive the injury is or how many brain cells die. So what kind of treatments are used for stroke when someone presents to the emergency department?
Mm-hmm. When a person presents to the emergency room, what we will do is do a quick physical exam to clarify the nature of their difficulty. We'll do a CAT scan to clarify if there's any bleeding into the brain or if it appears to be a lack of blood supply stroke, an ischemic stroke. If it's one of those more common ischemic strokes, then we consider how can we get the blood started again? How blood flow started again? How can we get rid of that clot? We approach it in a couple different ways. Number one, we have clot busters, tissue plasminogen activator. It's a clot buster that we can give into the vein that can help to break up that clot that is blocking the blood flow and get the blood flow started again. And that's sometimes effective. Another specialized approach to treatment is an approach in which we actually advance a small plastic tube called a catheter from an artery down in the groin all the way up into the blockage, and we remove the blockage directly via this little catheter. And so interventional neuroradiologists, neurosurgeons, and some neurologists do that procedure in which we actually remove the clot directly from the artery.
That is just sounds absolutely amazing.
Well, it really is. And on occasion, you'll see somebody who has a severe difficulty, paralysis on one side of the body, inability to speak. We'll go up, have one of our colleagues remove that clot, and essentially immediately they're able to start moving. They're able to start speaking and understanding you. It's really remarkable what can sometimes occur.
Bob, some of our listeners might have a question about imaging for stroke. So, you know, we're all familiar with CT scans or CAT scans, which are essentially kind of fancy x-rays because they take a lot of x-rays and put them together. But an MRI we think of as sort of being a fancier test. Mm-hmm. Why do you use a CT or CAT scan at first instead of an MRI?
Well, it's a great question. And CAT scan tends to be available in virtually any emergency room. Even many very small hospitals in rural areas have a CAT scan available. And the key question, Helena, at the time they present to the emergency room is there any evidence of bleeding into the brain tissue? And is there already a stroke, a large stroke that we can see on the scan? So a CAT scan often can give us the information that we need. And then we can follow that up with an MRI scan in a more leisurely pace, if you will, outside of the emergency setting.
You know, I think one of the most frustrating things at times for patients and family members is this concept of prognosis. So how we know how much function someone will recover if they do lose function during a stroke. Mm-hmm. And it seems like when I'm seeing patients in the hospital and speaking to members of your team, that it's hard to determine that right away. How do you know about prognosis and how long does it take?
It can be difficult to say with certainty. Now, that said, there are several factors that we can consider, including what is the stroke or how does the stroke appear on the scan, whether it be CAT scan or MRI scan? What's the size of the stroke? But more importantly, what is the clinical exam? As we are examining our patients, what is the nature of their deficit? When they present to the emergency room and after we've implemented any emergency treatment, what is the deficit at day one or day two or day three? And that can help to guide us in terms of guiding the family and the patient regarding the prognosis. But again, there are other complex issues we consider too in terms of their other medical issues and their age, because that can affect their prognosis in terms of how they might improve in the weeks and months ahead.
Bob, a little earlier, we were talking about signs and symptoms, and I wanted to ask you a question about this concept of TIAs.
Yes.
So if someone has been told that they are having TIAs, what does that mean? Mm-hmm. And does that portend a higher risk of mm-hmm. a stroke in the future?
Yeah, thank you for that question. And a TIA is a transient ischemic attack. Transient, meaning it comes and goes. Ischemic, meaning it's due to a lack of blood supply to the brain. An attack, meaning it typically comes on quickly. So a TIA. And so patients who have a TIA have the symptoms like we talked about a little while ago, but they come and go. They resolve in several minutes or several hours. But importantly, if a person has those symptoms, don't ignore those because they're a very important warning sign of a potential stroke that may occur in the hours or days or weeks ahead. And so do seek care because we can look into, we can investigate why did that TIA happen? And then we can go ahead and implement the best stroke prevention strategy. And certainly when it comes to a stroke, if we can prevent a stroke either by controlling risk factors for stroke, which we'll talk about subsequently, or if they've had a TIA and we can do something about that and prevent them from having a stroke, then that's the best for the patient.
I think that's a great point to make, Bob, because sometimes, you know, we see people in a similar situation who might have some chest pain, but it goes away when they sit down and rest or turn the television on. Same thing with these TIA type of symptoms, that they're not something to ignore. It means you need to get medical attention.
Yeah. And understandably, human nature is such that if something comes and goes, we kind of ignore it and carry on with our busy lives. But when it comes to something like a TIA, my encouragement is please do seek care for that, because there may be some relatively easy stroke prevention strategies that can be put into place to prevent them from having a stroke from which it may be more difficult to recover.
You mentioned risk factors. What are risk factors, and are there some that individuals can improve?
When we talk about risk factors, these are things that occur in a patient's or in a person's life that put them at higher risk of having a stroke. And the controllable or treatable risk factors include high blood pressure, cigarette smoking, diabetes, high cholesterol. Those are the big four, if you will. And then there are others that include what's called sleep apnea, which is a sleep disorder, obesity, a sedentary lifestyle, not getting any activity to speak of at all, heavy alcohol use. Those are some of those factors that we can control or treat in some way. And then, of course, age, important risk factor for stroke that we can't do much about. And also, there are certain race ethnicities, African-Americans, Hispanics, that are at somewhat higher risk of stroke, so not a, a controllable or treatable risk factor.
I think it's kind of fascinating, Bob, that, and I've said this before on this program, that so many of the disease states have some very common risk factors. We talk about smoking, we talk about high blood pressure, we talk about risk factors for cardiac disease and other risk factors. And it's kind of amazing that they seem to portend a lot of illnesses, not just stroke.
Well, you're right. And several of the risk factors we talked about today are risk factors for vascular disease, meaning affecting the arteries in the body. And at the same time, one treats the risk factors for the vascular disease of the neck or brain, one is also having benefit in terms of lessening the risk of heart artery disease or arteries down in the legs, for example. So you're right. It does affect the body in a positive way if we can control these risk factors very broadly.
It's a good time for a little advertisement about regular healthcare and seeing a healthcare professional, whether that be a primary care provider or otherwise, to discuss what we can do to be healthier. It's an important thing to keep in mind.
No, you're exactly right. And when it comes to these risk factors, just being aware of one's blood pressure, and if it is elevated, there's so many different medications, some of which are quite inexpensive, tolerated very well, and can control the risk factor of high blood pressure, or having one's doctor or advanced practice provider help them to reduce smoking or control their diabetes better. Or if a person has high cholesterol, start with a good diet, a very healthy diet. And then if that's not effective, there are excellent medicines available to lower cholesterol. So in other words, knowing about the existence of these risk factors is really important for a person because they can be oftentimes controlled.
I'm so grateful that you're here today, Bob, talking to us about this really important topic and so common as well. Any last words of wisdom or comments for our listeners?
My main comment is know those symptoms of stroke, know the risk factors for stroke. And if you do see a friend or loved one, or if you are experiencing those symptoms of a stroke, call 911 because we may have some therapies available for you to lessen the impact of that stroke on your life.
Bob, would you tell us that FAST, F-A-S-T, one more time?
Absolutely. The FAST acronym includes F for face drooping, A for arm weakness, S, speech slurring, and T, time to call 911 and seek emergency medical care.
Wonderful. Our thanks to Mayo Clinic neurologist and stroke expert, Dr. Robert Brown, for being here with us today to discuss the warning signs of stroke.
Mayo Clinic Q&A is a production of the Mayo Clinic News Network and is available wherever you get and subscribe to your favorite podcasts. To see a list of all Mayo Clinic podcasts, visit newsnetwork.mayoclinic.org and then click on Podcasts. And that wraps this week's installment of MedClinic Radio, a production of Syndication Networks of Chicago. Our executive producer is Randy Meyer, and I'm your host, Gina Tedesco. Thanks for joining us, and we hope you'll join us again next time for more MedClinic Radio. Syndication Network.